Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network Weekly Lecture Series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
And I would like to introduce Dr. Aaron Lazar, who's the Chancellor and Dean of the and Senior Psychiatrist at the University of Massachusetts Medical School at Worcester. I met Dr. Lazar about 1.5 years ago. My son is a medical student there, and he invited me to come to a book signing event when Dr. Lazar was releasing his book on apology, and I agreed to come and was totally enthralled with the whole concept of his book and stood in the book signing line, and somehow I didn't get my book signed, but I did manage to introduce myself and say I worked at Wellesley, and I would love to see him come to speak at Wellesley because I thought he had just a terrific message, and Wellesley was this very diverse community. And at the table he said, yes, when can we do it? Let's set up a date. So we hit a few roadblocks along the way, but here he is tonight, and I'm delighted to hear about that. And Dr. Lazar has won numerous awards in both medicine and for his teaching over many years in the fields. But there's one award that stands out, at least in my opinion, that I'd like to mention. Dr. and Mrs. Lazar have adopted 8 children of 3 different races. And I think he mentioned tonight at dinner that 7 were teenagers at the same time. How would anybody like to try and do that? I don't know. But in 2001, they were both awarded the Congressional Coalition on Adoption Angels in Adoption Award, which I think is just pretty amazing to get recognition in that area. But moving on with the lecture and discussion to follow, I have to let you all know that this lecture is being recorded by Wellesley College and will be available online as a webcast and podcast through our partnership with WGBH Forum Network at forumwgbh.org. Thank you very much, and Dr. Lazar.
It's working now? Just as a brief follow-up, on a philosophic moment, I was discussing with my wife what courage was. Courage, you know, the willingness to take a risk for a higher cause. And I said, I think it took courage to adopt 8 children. What do you think? And my wife said, courage? That was a piece of cake. So I said, so what's courage? She says, going to one of those faculty cocktail parties and smiling for 4 hours. So everybody has their definition. It's quite a privilege for me to be able to be here. To speak before this special audience of students, faculty, administrators, and friends of the campus. It was also very fortunate for me that I fell upon this subject back in 1992. It is so interesting. I will go anywhere, speak anywhere, because it's so important. And it came at a time when the importance of apologies began to increase in worldwide. And I think, in fact, we're in a cultural change in the importance of apologies. That's not to say that people know how to do it properly or that the apologies cause more harm than good, but that'll be part of the subject here. But I just tell you, in this fortunate situation I'm in, the audiences that I speak to last Monday, would you believe I spoke to the police academy in Boston and several months before to the attorney general's office? You won't be surprised to know that you're shocked. the attorney, but what wouldn't surprise you is that I spend my weekends going to synagogue churches, and I have my first Hindu temple coming up in a while because apology is so close to repentance. An academic audience is so. To be interested in the subject and to have the passion that I have for it and to be able to speak to diverse groups is just a great source of excitement. You know, trying to work with difficult faculty who think they ought to have Stradivarius violin, so to speak, every other day, this is different. So it's a great pleasure for me to talk about the subject. I'll attempt to communicate a twofold message of this talk. First, apologies one of the most profound healing interchanges between individuals, people, groups, and nations. The party making the apology can be relieved of guilt and shame and often avoid the rupture of a relationship. And the person receiving the apology enjoys the restoration of their dignity, enjoys the healing of the relationship. So these broken relationships can be healed, restored, and even strengthened. I'm not going to get used to all these things. I'm not very good at this. That's not an apology. It's just a comment. So this is what apology does. So apologies actually can not only restore a relationship, they can actually enhance a relationship because something is discovered between the two people that hadn't happened before. So it can make a relationship better. It can just restore the relationship. It can restore it in part, and it can damage a relationship. That's very important to pay attention to when you hear about the awful apologies that become insults. That surprise any of you that you can actually insult someone with an apology? Have you ever had anybody say to you or you say to them, be honest, just squirm in your seat so I can know who you are. I'm sorry for whatever I did. Right? Very bad. And the other one that's very common, I'm sorry if you were upset. Right? What that means, if you're so, you're laughing like you've done that. what that's really saying is, if you're so thin-skinned that it bothers you, I'm sorry, are you happy now? So those are really very condescending, and it's very easy. It's easier to make condescending ones, but it doesn't do you any good. Actually, it destroys relationships. I'm not here to tell you how you should feel in response to these. I'm here to tell you why you feel the way you do. So when you feel angry and you think you should be feeling grateful over the apology, now you'll, after the end of this hour, you'll understand why. But the feelings are pretty spontaneous when you have these insulting apologies. There's the other notion about these awful apologies. There was a whole spate of them in last June. I demand an apology. Anybody who demands an apology does not want to have an apology. They don't want to heal it. All that's a statement of humiliation. And there were so many of them that the Washington Post asked me to write an op-ed piece on that, and I did at the cost of no sleep for 3 nights because they had a deadline and I wasn't going to miss the opportunity. But the last line of the op-ed piece was, let's see. The thirst for apologizing in Washington these days, though, is all about pushing apart. If you ask me, it's a sorry spectacle indeed. That was the last line. Well, just this past Saturday, just to make it current, 2/11/06 in the New York Times, a pseudo-apology by the Danish editor who authorized the decision to publish the derogatory cartoons about Prophet Muhammad, quote, I feel sorry if Muslims feel offended, and that was not the intention. Already a terrible. I feel sorry. First of all, saying sorry is ambiguous whether it's an apology or not. I'll explain that later on. If someone was offended, of course they were offended. And he simultaneously announced that he was taking an indefinite vacation from the newspaper. And you can read into that what you want. But let me give you an example before I go on into the meat of this talk. A story of an apology that changed someone's life. A 71-year-old man came up to me after at a social event in Worcester, and he said, "Dr. Lazar, I want to thank you for that lecture. I thought it was really good, and I told my friends it was a good talk, and then I realized why I liked it. I had a need for it. I had done something to my best friend when we were both 10 years old, and it's been haunting me ever since. I have nightmares about it, I think about it, I feel terrible about it." And so I thought and thought, and after about 2 or 3 months of cogitating on this, because it's not easy to make a good apology, I decided I would write out the apology. This man's name was Manny, and the person to whom he wanted to apologize was Eddie. So I wrote it out, and I went to his house, and I rang the doorbell, And he recognized me. He said, "Hello, Manny." And I said, "Hello, Eddie." And I said, "Eddie, would you read this?" And he said, I couldn't say it to him, but I wanted to watch his face when I read it. And so he read the apology, and he put it down, and he smiled, and he put his arms around Manny, and he hugged him, and he said, "Manny, I love you." And he then wrote me 2 years later, and he said, "Eddie died, but the fact that I made the apology meant all the difference to me. My nightmares stopped, and I could live with myself, and thank you again." So those are unusual. But one of the morals of that story is it's never too late to apologize. Sometimes when the person dies, you have a problem. Some some religions suggest going to the gravesite, which may not be a bad idea psychologically. So that's just to show you really what can be done. Let me get into some of the definitions about that, because that's a source of great misunderstanding. An apology is an admission of responsibility for a mistake or an offense, followed by an expression of regret, remorse, and forbearance. Forbearance, commitment not to do it again. There's another meaning of apology, apologia, which comes from the Greek. The word apology comes from the Greek. Means to justify or explain. And so the only time you ever hear that, when people talk about the president's apologist, the president's not apologizing. This one never does, rarely. But I'll get into it later, that the only time presidents apologize is for what their predecessors did. They're very good at that. Clinton was a great apologizer, but he was good for things that he didn't do. The last one, I'll tell you more about it later, who apologized for what he did, I think, was Abraham Lincoln. It was a long time ago. He gave an apology for slavery, which I'll describe later on. So we're not talking about the apologia. So when you read about Plato's apology or Christian apologetics, it's not about apologies. It's about justification and explanations. Now, the first definition is not that simple. It's an acceptance of responsibility for a mistake. Now, you really don't apologize for an honest mistake. If I conduct a search for a chair of a department, say the Department of Surgery, and I appoint a great search committee, and they do a very thorough job, and the person failed, I don't think I have to apologize for it. I did the best I could. And another example of that would be General Eisenhower, when he commanded the Normandy invasion in 1944, he had a letter in his pocket that said something like the following: "We lost the invasion. Many of our soldiers were killed. They fought nobly. We did the best we could. All the responsibility belongs to me." I'm not sure I'd call that an apology. Everybody knows he did the best he could. Everybody knows that he consulted with everybody. Of course, he won the invasion, but that was the letter in case they lost. He didn't want to sit down and write it afterwards. But at any rate, most people know what an offense is. Sometimes if you make a mistake, and it's a stupid mistake, supposing I'm walking down the street with a newspaper in front of my face and I knock somebody over, that's a dumb mistake. It wasn't personal, but for that, one ought to apologize. So there's some subtleties in all of that. Let me go back to that. The word apology is misused many times. And people overuse it now. So some people will say, "Did you ever pass a hotel under construction? It says, 'We apologize for the inconvenience.'" Well, that's really a dumb use of the word. There's no forbearance. If they had to do it over again, they would, right? What's a more accurate word? We regret the inconvenience. We're sorry for the inconvenience. But to apologize for it doesn't make any sense. There's even a worse one I've seen. Parking garage. You pass a parking garage that's filled, and there's a sign that says, "We apologize that the garage is filled." Well, they love it when it's filled. They would do it again over and over again. So the word has lost some of its precision. Also, as I'll talk later, to say "I apologize" and nothing else for a relatively serious offense, a betrayal of trust, say, "Oh, I apologize," it's never enough anyway. It needs to be modified in some ways, which we'll talk about. The other word that's interesting to look at is the word "sorry." Is it an apology to say "I'm sorry"? And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. If you go to a house of mourning and you say, I'm so sorry for your loss, that's not an apology. So there's a compassionate sorry, and then there's an apology sorry, namely, I'm so sorry I bumped into you, I wasn't looking, can I help you pick up the bundles? That's an acknowledgement of an offense or a mistake. So a lot of times people, politicians, will use the word sorry to pretend that they're apologizing when they have no intent. And I'll give you some examples of that in when we get to the discussion of the Abu Ghraib incident. Our administration gave compassionate sorries, and then they even tricked either the Globe or the New York Times to call it an apology when it clearly wasn't. So it's keep that in mind when you want to apologize. Make sure when you say sorry, you know what you're saying sorry for. The other word that's interesting is repentance. What's the difference between repentance and apology? Well, repentance is a religious word, and when you look up the definition of repentance, or in Hebrew, teshuva, it's a turning away from evil, returning to good, returning to God. So that's not an apology. But when you read in the Christian Jewish literature, and I'm studying Hindu and Islamic, and so I'm leaving it out only because of my ignorance. And I'm going to, if you invite me back next year, I'll talk about that. So I'm going to just stick with these two religions currently. Apologies are the antecedent events to repentance. So in Catholicism, for instance, the confession is the acknowledgement of the offense. And so the confession and all what follows is a way of apologizing to lead to repentance. So I'm going to be using them interchangeably, but they're not quite the same. So repentance is turning away from sin, and the means towards it, the mechanism towards it, is the apology. When you see something in a cartoon, it really captures that this. That, so you know that it's similar. The apologies, I talked about the increasing importance of them. Why are there more apologies in the world? And so what I'm going to tell you now is all speculation. It's no, there's no hard evidence for it. I'll tell you, though, what's not speculation. My assistants, I'm sort of computer illiterate, but I have two wonderful assistants who are not. And I said, look up the New York Times and the Washington Post, being the two, I think, most international newspapers in the country, and count how many articles there are with the word apology or apologize in it in the year 1992, 1993, all the way up to 2002. And it went up like a curve, and it doubled. How many apologies there were in 1992, there were twice as many in 2002. So something is going on. You could say, well, they're just picking them up in the newspaper, or you can say there's an increase in it. But there are an increase in it, and the other proof of that was columnists over and over again say, what's this apology craze? In 1993, I remember an article in Time magazine that said, last month, everybody apologized for everything, and it had a whole bunch of international apologies. So I think something is happening. It began at the end of World War II, I believe. The war is over. Only 50 million people were killed, right? 30 million Russians, 6 million Jews, and on. And people were saying, and the French and the German had terrible wars in 1870 and 1914 and 1940, and people were saying, this has to stop. And it became that apologies began to be seen as signs of civilization rather than signs of weakness. So there began to be turns during that time. And even you could think of Vatican II. Some of the things in Vatican II were de facto apologies. They weren't admissions of fault, but they were changes. Pope John, for instance, changed the Good Friday. I think that's what it was. The material was anti-Semitic. He said, we can't do that anymore. He just took it out. And he led the way for Vatican II, which said, which announced that Roman Catholicism and Christianity has to behave in a certain way towards everyone who's not Christian. You don't have to believe the faith, but you have to be treated with dignity. So these were responses to what happened. Also, we had the women's movement, we had the civil rights movement, and all of these things, people are getting newfound powers and saying, you owe us an explanation. You have to acknowledge what has happened before. The women became more empowered, and women always did it better than men, right? I don't have to. And in fact, as women become more important in all the professions, I think men are going to have to learn from it, because apologies are effective. And if you don't apologize, you're going to lose. The biggest movement came actually in the 1990s, I believe. Pope John Paul's request for repentance for the sins of the children of the church for the past 2,000 years in the Jubilee year. Those of you who are Catholic better know this. The Jubilee year, the 2000, is the year for repentance, right? And so that became pretty important. And if the Pope can do it, it's not a wimpy thing to do. And something about the millennium by itself. I remember there was a story about George Steinbrenner came to apologize to Yogi Berra for the way that he fired him. And he went to Yogi Berra's house in New Jersey, and he said, "If you accept my apology, I will carry you across the George Washington Bridge to Yankee Stadium in a rickshaw," he said. And someone went up to Mrs. Berra, Carmine Berra, and said, "What's going on?" And Carmine Berra said, "It's the millennium. Everybody's doing it. You know, it's like a New Year's thing." But I think the most important event that happened during the last couple of decades had to do with the world being more populated and being a global village. When I was your age in college, there were about 2.3 billion people in the world. There are 6.3 billion people in the world. So we're bumping into each other. And now we're in an age of this global village where everything that happens affects everybody else. If Israel and Palestine are at war, big trouble everywhere. If countries are starving in Africa, big trouble everywhere. I mean, everyone's got to be concerned, because it can unsettle the entire world. If Chernobyl explodes, or if a Russian submarine is rusting, it affects everybody. If we spill oil off the coast of Maine, it affects everybody, at least Canada, and vice versa. Also, the technology. You all use email, right? How many of you, let's have an honest raise of hand, how many of you have ever been really mad at somebody and pressed the button after you wrote a letter letting someone know how you felt? And you thought it was a brilliant letter. You thought it was really good until you sent it. Their audience is where 50% of the people will admit to that. When I was a young man, we would have letters, and you always have, it was a female secretary. And I remember one secretary was not only a good secretary, she was my sister-in-law, she was my wife's sister. And I remember I would write a letter, and your cognition is disturbed when you're humiliated or really angry. You think things are really terrific, and you want to act in ways that you'll regret. So you press the button. Well, I would write these letters, and then 3 days later, I would say, "Janet, did you send that letter?" And she would say, "Of course not. That's my job, to keep you from looking stupid. But I did call your wife." I run a cottage industry at the medical school of people who send dumb emails and then come rushing in and ask me how to apologize for it now. This, on a more serious note, there was a state senator in North Carolina who got an email that he thought was really brilliant that said, "What made America great was white Christian men." Well, he sent it to everybody in the legislature to tell what a wonderful email he found. He spent the next 2 weeks, he did it on a Friday night, so there was no one there to tell him that he was going to get in big trouble. And so, you know, there was people who were not white, who were not Christian, who were not men in the legislature, as you can imagine. There was also an experience that happened in China. Way in one of the outlying provinces in China, there was an explosion. It was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I think 38 children were killed. And the prime minister, someone very high up, came out and said, "There's a mad bomber afoot." And the next day on the internet, the whole truth came out. It wasn't a mad bomber. The children were forced to make explosives or firecrackers or something. And he had to come back the next day and apologize. So there's nothing hidden anymore. Abu Ghraib, we have always treated our prisoners horribly. What happened in Abu Ghraib? You have the digital camera and the internet. The next day, everybody knew. I'm not condoning it with or without the camera, but one cannot get away with things so easily anymore. So we're in this kind of world that makes it hard to hide anything. So the world, I think that may be the biggest reason why all these apologies are coming kept coming together. This is a, the cartoons are great. Can you all read it in the back? I'm sorry, but someone has to put a stop to this endless cycle of apologizing. One could say, how can I generalize about private and public apologies? I think they're more alike than different, but I'll tell you what the differences are. One difference is that sincerity is less important than a public apology. A public apology can still accomplish something. If you violate somebody's airspace and you apologize, well, it shows that you admit you're wrong publicly and you humiliate yourself and whatever, even if you're a liar. But it's hard on a one-to-one to be able to do that. Public ones are less spontaneous because they're written and planned and you have a committee that writes them. It's also the public ones do it for the record, and so it's written. Sometimes it's difficult in determining who's the offender and who's the offended if one country is apologizing to somebody else. And sometimes the offense is caused by some predecessor. It raises the interesting question, which relates somewhat to slavery. Why do I have to apologize for something I didn't do? Can I be guilty of something that I didn't do? My answer to that is, you're not guilty for something you didn't do, but you should be ashamed of something for what you didn't do. I'm proud of the Marshall Plan. I'm proud of what the United States did, at least in World War II. But I didn't do it. I didn't fight there. I was a little kid. If you can be proud of something, if you can be proud of the Patriots, you can be ashamed, too. So you have to buy the whole thing. Also, it's like buying a house. Once you're an American citizen, once you bought the house, you own everything that's wrong with it. You can't have the good stuff without the bad stuff. Also, with regard to slavery, people made money on it, and so there were some material things that we had. So a lot of reasons why I think it's appropriate to consider apologies for things that you weren't there for. If you want to be a citizen, you own everything this country did, good and bad. Enough said on that. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Just briefly, and I don't want to get into the meat of what I want to get into. Women apologize more than men, you know that. Women apologize better than men, you know that. Women sometimes apologize. A lot of women will tell me they apologize too much, and as women are feeling their strengths and development, people will come to me and say, how can I stop apologizing for something I didn't do? And I've seen a few women come up to me after talks privately who looked very depressed, and they wanted to stop apologizing so much. And the stories three of them told me were that they were abused as children. You could imagine a father, a big tyrannical father, coming charging after a little girl, and the girl saying, Daddy, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. She learned how to say you're sorry to ward off people for nothing that you've done. So I think that, in general, the women sociologists who write about this talk about women are more concerned about restoring relationships. Men are more concerned about winning and losing. Take that for. I have a lot of feminine traits. I had a wonderful mother. If you know about American or British apologies, you don't know much about other nations. Don't think you can transfer them because the subtleties are enormous. Japanese apologies. Japanese, they're much more subtle and much more, how do you apologize to a man, to a woman, to an older, to younger. But they tend not to apologize to outsiders. It's an island, and they apologize to the Japanese people for Pearl Harbor, but not to the Americans, because it would. I just say this to point out the differences, and you can't, if you want to travel. Actually, someone said in Japan, if you have to go to court, first apologize. If you go to court in the United States, the last thing you want to do is apologize. So you only know about one culture. This section and the other section, I think, are the most important things that I want to communicate to you. You would think that there's some common way in which healing takes place in an apology, that it's sort of an obvious question. And I tell you, I've studied about 2,000 apologies, and I've teased out about 10 or so different dynamics in an apology. And it's useful to know that because if you apologize and you think it's a good apology, you may not have met the need of the person who'd been hurt. And so I'll try to take you through these ones. The most common one, when I say to people, have you ever apologized? Someone apologized to you and it felt really good. Something good happened. What happened is someone will say, well, we used to be like this. And after what you did to me, we're like this. And now you apologize and we're like that. It sort of restores balance. And so that's the most common one. And there's all kinds of wonderful stories that describe it really well. One of them, I'm going to tell stories that have more than one function, but one will stand out. But I'll leave this on the board so you can see where they are. Rashid Wheeler. I'm interested whether Rashid is an Islamic name and whether there might have been some prejudice in there. Rashid Wheeler is a 22-year-old young man who was a strong safety. That's a football position for Northwestern University. And they were practicing in the summer, and the coach was forcing him to do some exercises that were too strenuous for the summer. They were not acceptable by the league, but they were doing that. And Rashid was sitting on the sidelines having an asthma attack, choking for 40 minutes until he died, and nobody paid any attention to him. And the mother got a call from her oldest son, who was told about it by a friend, not from the coach. No one from the school called him. And then the school said he was taking some drug, but the autopsy showed that he had asthma and nothing else. There was no drug. And after a while, the school decided to give the mother a settlement of $16 million. And she said, I don't want it. I want an apology. So what did she want? And so it makes it so clear what she wanted. She said, I want an apology. I want an explanation for the delay. I want a copy of the physical exam. I want a permanent memorial. I fault them for their lack of humanity. And get this. This is to illustrate the self-respect and dignity. I'm not going to let anyone take the shine off my son. That's the dignity. Restore his dignity. You're saying he's a drug addict, in effect. You're saying it was his fault, and you people know that's not true, and so you're denigrating my son. They're not going to take the shine off my son. I'm not going to let them diminish what happened to him. I want my son to be proud. And by the way, she also wanted some suffering. So what did she say? And also, part of the settlement, you have to fire the coach. Not a bad idea. So she wanted suffering. She wanted the restoration of self-respect and dignity, and maybe the validation that it was nobody's fault except theirs. Because sometimes you always wonder, what did I do badly as a mother? So you can see different dynamics of what she needed and what that apology was for. The second one, I'll have to tell you another personal story that I got such pleasure out of. I was invited to go to Nice, France, all paid for myself and my wife by a specialist in cancer prevention. And he said, just come and just introduce the other chancellor. And I said, I can't do that and accept this honorarium for not doing anything. He says, oh, you're so prudish about that. Well, give a lecture. So I said, the only thing I'm talking on these days is apology. He says, that'll be good enough. So I succumbed, and I took my wife, and I went to Nice, France. And so I'm the keynote speaker one afternoon. At 4:30 in the afternoon, I speak from 4:30 to 5, and the moderator was sort of dozing. And at 5 o'clock when I finished, there were 350 people in the room, and I really enjoyed the talk. And I said, can I take questions? And everyone had their hands raised, you know, and I really enjoyed that. In fact, afterwards, people followed me with tape recorders to ask me personal questions about their mother-in-laws not talking to their son-in-law. It was all personal. It had nothing to do with cancer prevention. So at 5:20, 20 minutes into the question and answer period, a big bear of a man stands up. He's about 6'7", and he's walking towards me. And I'm really a little shaken. And I look at the schedule, and I realize that he's the next speaker who starts at 5, and I'm 20 minutes into his talk, right? Groan. Right. So I said, we have to stop now, and I left. And I pass him in the street, This is true confessions. You know, I'm not proud of myself, but I try to get better every time. This damn book is like a conscience on my chest. So I don't say anything to him, and he passes me in the street a couple of times, you know, right in the Riviera. It's really beautiful there. And he gives me a dirty look, and I say to myself, he's from Nebraska. I've never been there, and I'm not going there. And no offense to Nebraska, I'm just not a well-traveled person. So the last night before we go, I go to a French restaurant with my wife at 7 o'clock, and nobody eats there. They eat at 9 o'clock in France, right? But you've been there. So I go in with my wife, and you know the rest of the story. Where do they seat us? Next to him. There are only four couples there, and I'm sitting next to this guy and his wife. And I turn my chair away so I don't have to look at him. And so I'm going home tomorrow. And so then we finish first, and I get up to leave, and I walk to the door with my wife about 40 feet away, and I can't stand it anymore. This book is here. I say, Louise, wait here. There's something I have to do. So I turn around and go back, and I know I have to make an apology. So I said, Dr. Lynch, I said, I'm here to talk about last Thursday night. I said, you know, it was stupid of me or careless of me that I wasn't paying attention. I just hope I feel really badly about it, and I hope I didn't mess up your schedule, blah, blah, blah. And this guy, he's standing up now, 6'7", staring at me. And as soon as I say that, big smile comes over his face, puts his arm on my shoulder, and he said, Dr. Lazar, you gave a great talk. And see, an apology is a gift you give to somebody, and they almost always return the gift. I almost knew it was going to happen, yet I just wanted to avoid it. I'm realizing how stupid I was. I didn't want to think about it, that I was so careless, you know, not to pay attention that there was going to be another speaker. So then I have a pretty good sense of humor, so I said to him, oh, he says, his wife is sitting there. So his wife says, he says to his wife, I just wish you were there. You would have loved it, because she was a psychiatric nurse or a psychiatric social worker. That would have been her subject. So I said, I understand that you're internationally famous. Now he really feels good, right? He says, how do you know? I said, I met your wife in the museum 2 days ago, and she told me. So now the three of us are laughing. My wife is 40 feet away. I walk back to the door, and I said to my wife, what are you smiling about? You couldn't even hear it. She said, I didn't need to. I could just read the lips. It was like one of those soaps on television that had a happy ending, or three friends who were estranged who had a reconciliation. The next morning, they sat us next to him in the hotel, and we were having a wonderful time. He was telling us about his trip to Europe. But that was the restoration of dignity. The offense was, your talk isn't important. I can go 20 minutes into your talk, and I'm more important than you are. And so that was, another example of the restoration of dignity. So this is we're talking about self-respect and dignity. Another part of an apology is I need to know that we have shared values. So when McVeigh, the guy who blew up the federal building, when he said, they said, do you show any remorse? He said, no, it was collateral damage, killing all these kids. And what do people do? It always says, notice in newspapers, it will always say showed remorse or showed no remorse. If showed no remorse, it means you're an animal. You don't even belong in the human dimension. You should go off to Mars somewhere. And it really repels people. Just get angry at you. Showed no remorse, you don't have the same values. There was a Japanese legislator who, in response to a question about some Japanese male student gangbanging a bunch of young girls, he said, this shows how virile our men are. Can you imagine? And what he didn't imagine was there were a lot of females in the legislature. They just about hung him out to dry, and he had to make crawling on his knees. The prime minister had to make some comments. He says, my remarks were inappropriate. It was a fatal mistake. It was a fatal mistake to make amends by actively addressing rape-related issues, on and on. The other one that happened here that some of you, if you're sports enthusiasts, may remember, Bob Ryan is a well-respected reporter for the Globe. And he was asked about the wife of one of the star players for the Mrs. Jason Kidd. Jason Kidd is a star player for the Nets. And the wife comes to the games with a son and harasses the Celtics. And so Lobel, the announcer, says, what do you think of Mrs. Kidd? And he says, I'd like to smack her. little did he know that she already had been smacked by a husband and was in court over abuse. He may or may not have known it. And Lobel said, "Do you want to take back what you said?" And he said, "No, I stand by what I said." So the Boston Globe suspended him for a month without pay and all of the things that go with it. He apologized, and it sounded to me like a genuine apology, but it didn't even matter. The fact that the Globe and the culture forces people to behave civilly is a sign of civilization. People could say nasty things about minorities, about anybody, even majorities, about Muslims, about Jews, about Italians, and get away with it. There's something really wrong. And so for him to publicly say, "I apologize, it was a figure of speech, but I had atrocious judgment, it was a colossal error," that's important. So so apologies show that there are some shared values in society. Another one, of course, the defended party will be safe in future encounters, because an apology is a promise for the future. Once you apologize and then you repeat it again, it doesn't matter, it's lost. If someone is married to an alcoholic, man or woman, and "I apologize, it won't happen again," and it happens the next week, there's not much you can do about it. A lot of people don't like to believe this one, but seeing the offender punished, that's really an important part of a lot of apologies. The one, the woman whose son died, she wanted to see them suffer. When the United States inadvertently bombed the Chinese embassy in one of the Yugoslavian states, they didn't answer the phone call from President Clinton for a week. They wanted to see him dangle and suffer. And again, on a more personal note, these two wonderful assistants I have came to me one day at 5 o'clock and said, "We are so far behind, let's all come in an hour early tomorrow." I thought that was pretty generous of them, right? And so they came in an hour early and I overslept. And I came in, actually I forgot about it, and I came in and said, "Good morning," and no response, backs to me. And then finally I figured out what I did, and I made as good an apology as you can imagine, nothing. Then I thought I would bribe them. "How about if I take you to lunch today?" "Lunch, that'll just get us further behind, what good is that?" Then, "Well, what happened today?" "Well, we gave up our yoga lesson to be here for you to get this work done." On and on, until there was nothing I could do, until about 10:30 as I walked by them, one looked at the other and said, "I think he suffered enough." So it's a minor thing. But I am aware with my wife, if something happens and my wife might say, "Let's get this settled before we go to bed," and I'll sometimes say, "Let's talk about it in the morning. You know, you haven't suffered enough, so I have another 12 hours. But I think there's something not just manipulative in that. I think there's something real that you need to feel the other person has suffered somewhat like you have. Another thing that happens is that you need some validity that what happened really did happen. Don't you wonder when someone offends you, did I make it up? Was I being oversensitive? And then when the person apologizes, they say, "I did this, it was really wrong, and I know that it was inappropriate." There's something validating about that. On a global level, the validation is so important that any of you have Armenian relatives or friends? You never forget what happened, right? You learn about it as soon as you can hear. The Armenian massacre in 1915, 1.5 million people were killed by the Turks in forced marches. They want validation. The Turks may think they want reparations. The validation is more important, I think, than the reparation. There was a recent discussion of lynching in America where Congress, the Senate, had a voice vote as who's going to vote against lynching, even today, and they wouldn't put it in a recorded vote. It was going to be a voice vote, because someone had discovered, had written a book about it. But I was on an education radio television, a great granddaughter of a man who was lynched, and she said, "Someone is finally recognizing our pain. Just acknowledge it. Acknowledge what happened. That's who we are. That's what our identity is." There are 4 countries in Europe in which it is against the law to deny the Holocaust existed. Here you can argue against it. Someone said it's Looney Tunes. But in Poland, France, Belgium and Germany, if you say the Holocaust didn't exist, you can go to jail. That's how important the validation is for people. And so an apology is a validation. That's one of the major functions. And it wasn't my fault. That wasn't my fault is very important, because a lot of times you'll wonder, did I do it? It happens a lot with women who were raped. Just tell me it wasn't my fault. The boys who were assaulted by priests, some of them were paid $300,000-$400,000, and they wanted an apology. What did they want? Just tell me it wasn't my fault, and tell me you were sorry, that you were wrong. And I remember one priest said, I said every morning after, I said I was sorry, and they just didn't get it. In Vermont Social and Rehabilitation Department, there were two girls who were impregnated by their stepfather, and the department apologized, and one young woman said, it's getting over the feeling that I was the bad girl. So part of an apology then is to be validated, to be freed from fault, to have promises to the future, to seeing the offender punished. And the reparation is only a part of it. You know, people worry about reparations for slavery. There's a lot more to an apology for slavery. There's an acknowledgement that it really did happen, that it was wrong, that it's against our moral stand. There's a lot more to it than some people think. There's a very interesting one, I thought, too, another Holocaust story that says it so clearly. Reba Schaefer, a 75-year-old Holocaust survivor, received $400 from the Swiss government for the Swiss complicity with the Nazis. When she received the payment, she said, "The amount means nothing. I care about the fact of it. No matter what it took, finally, after all these decades, somebody is saying, you suffered and we know it." And so it's very important for the offender, whether it's person to person or nation to nation, acknowledge what it was, acknowledge what you did. And I think in part of slavery, I don't think people understand what it was. And so there's a superficial knowledge of what slavery is. But when you read about Reconstruction, when you read about some of the atrocities, then you know what it is. So I think part of the dilemma in apologizing for slavery is we have the lack of knowledge what the offense really was, except in the most global way. Assurance that it's not our fault. When Clinton apologized for the Tuskegee experiment, many of you know what that was. The public health system did an experiment on black men and withheld penicillin when they knew that it could treat them. Clinton brought the surviving men in their 90s, 100s, amongst the other things he said, "You did nothing wrong." Why would he say that, except he knew that that's what they wanted and needed to hear and were entitled to hear? Because they must have been imagining, were we bad, were we wrong? Why would a country like this with these professed values do things that were so wrong? The reparation may or may not be necessary or important. The reparation will work if there's nothing personal. If you go to a restaurant and you had a miserable day, you and your friend, and you're really going to treat yourself, and you go there and you're waiting, you go to Paparazzi's, that's near where I'm, and you wait an hour and a half before the food comes, you are miserable. They really ruin your day. You had too much bread now, and the waiter... And the waiter comes and makes this profound apology. "I'm really sorry." You are unmoved until the waiter says, "The meal is free," right? But if you were a minority, or if you were an African American, and you knew that restaurant did that on purpose, Denny's was it that was responsible for that? That did treat blacks that way. If it were personal like that, the free meal isn't going to be enough, you know. Someone cannot treat you, because then you're dealing with a lack of dignity. But if it's nothing personal, then the reparation is gonna be okay. The other thing that's important in the other functions of an apology is the dialogue between the two people. Martha Minow in Vengeance and Forgiveness said, she was talking about the El Salvador Truth Commission. One could not listen to them without recognizing that the mere act of telling what had happened was an emotionally healing release, and they were more interested in recounting their story and being heard than having retribution, just to be able to talk to the other person about it, and I'll have other stories for that. Another one, there's a book called A Human Being Died That Night by Gabota Madik-Azila. I'm sure that's not the proper... This is a widow whose husband had been murdered by a man named de Kock, an apartheid criminal. And so this apartheid criminal is talking to her, not even making a real apology, but talking about what happened. She said, "De Kock is the only one who helped us retrace the steps of what really happened. You have no idea of how much a relief of knowing the truth about my husband was. He brought us the truth so we can now be with our husbands, understand what happened to them, and then release them again. And now I can mourn properly because this has helped me retrace his steps in life in order to let him go in death." And so there's something about the live interchange between the two people. And then finally, there's the empowerment. I'm not sure it's here. Empowerment of the offended party. I have the power to forgive you. I have the power in hospitals. If something goes wrong, if the doctors can say, "You have changed our procedures because now we know how we've been managing the records wrong or whatever wrong," the empowerment is a real important thing. You have the power to control the timing of the apology. You have a lot of power, the person who's receiving the apology, and I think that power means a great deal. I'm not sure if I'm caught up here. So what I've just described is the function of the apology. Now, this is a little subtle thing. I'm going to talk about the structure of the apology. What's the difference between function and structure? What's the function of a meal? The function of a meal is presentation, nutrition, cost. There's one more. The structure of the meal is the food that you put in and how you mix it. Well, so these are the functions of an apology. I want to talk about now how does one do it, and I think that's a little easier to understand. There are four parts of a complex apology. Not all four parts have to be there, but if the apology fails, one of them is missing. The first part is the confession, acknowledging the offense. What is it that went wrong? That's the most commonly messed up, failed part of the apology. The second is the explanation. Why did you do this? The third is the affective part, the expression of forbearance, the expression of remorse, the expression of humility, the expression of shame, and the last part is the reparation. But let me talk about how people destroy apologies. Keep in mind that this structure is what leads to the function, which I talked about before. This doesn't work. Will a blanket apology do, or do I have to guess what I did? So we're very ingenious at figuring out ways how to do it right. But let me tell you what I learned from my grandson. I have an 8-year-old grandson who lives with us, and so I experiment with him, teaching him how to apologize. He says, "All you care about is apology, apology." But one day when he was 6 years old, we were wrestling, which means he's punching me and climbing all over me, and I spot a can of instant whipped cream on the coffee table. So I said, "I'm going to take the whipped cream and squirt him here." So I go to squirt him, and he tries to get out of the way, but I got him a big wad of whipped cream, and he starts to scream, crying on top of his lungs. I said, "Gabriel, I'm so sorry." Now, it's a bad apology because I only said I'm so sorry. I didn't even say what I was sorry for, right? Bad apology. "Gabriel, I'm so sorry." And then he was screaming louder. I said, "Would you forgive me?" He says, "Pop-Pop, it's too late to forgive." So I was feeling rather helpless and stupid. So I go into my office about 10 feet away, and he follows me, and he's playing on the floor with his toys, and he's whimping for a half hour. And finally, I did the right thing, not realizing that I was doing it. I said, "Gabriel, I'm so sorry. What did you do with the whipped cream?" And he said, "Pop-Pop, I love the whipped cream. I bumped my head." So you've got to know what you're apologizing for. then it's easy to respond. I knew what he needed. When someone, I think you all do that. When a kid bumps his head, you rub it and you kiss it, right? That's the thing to do. I did that, and he stopped crying immediately. So I said, so the whimpering was over my failure. It wasn't over the pain. I mean, how could a grandfather who allegedly loves this boy not kiss it when he hurts his head? So I missed the whole thing. So I said, Gabriel, do you forgive me now? And he says, yes, Papa, because you kissed my head, and I know you're going to make me pancakes for breakfast tomorrow. So he already had the reparations. That was 2 years later, this past summer, I'm napping, deep sleep on the porch in the middle of the afternoon, and he comes in to get a toy, and he gets the toy, and it slips out of his hand, and he drops it on the floor and wakes me up, and I'm staring at him, and he says, Pop-Up, it was an accident. I didn't like that apology, so I stared at him, and he said, Pop-Up, I'm sorry I woke you up out of your sleep. It was an accident. And I said, Gabriel, that was really a grown-up apology. people don't make good apologies. There are a few classic apologies. There was a wonderful apology by a guy named Gnomes, who's the head of the Indian Affairs, who was a Native American. And he wrote out everything that this country has done to Native Americans. Are you familiar with it? Brings me to tears to read it. Another one, which was quite extraordinary, was Weizsäcker, the president of the Federal Republic of Germany, had an hour-long speech to the Bundestag apologizing to the world for what Nazi Germany did to everybody. And he went through detail by detail by detail. And I started to choke up in tears. It was so moving. It's an apology. It's an apology for slavery. He says, what was this war really all about? What's the cause of this war? He said, slavery. You have to read it again in the context of this. And he said, what is the offense of slavery? Slavery, it is a sin to earn your bread from the sweat of another man's face. Very clear, very specific, very religious man. And then he says, and what's the cause of it? What's the explanation? What's the cause of it? Money. Who made money? The North made money. The South made money. Everybody. Is that something about Abraham Lincoln? Everybody made money on this war. What is the punishment going to be now? What's the reparation? Maybe God gives us this war so that all the blood that was shed from the lash, from the whip, from 250 years of slavery, has to be shed by the sword before this war can be over. And then that's the angry God. And then the loving God, he ends with what all of you know, with malice toward none and charity for all. Let us strive on to finish the work wherein to bind up the nation's wounds, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace amongst ourselves and with all nations, which we never got to, but the sentiment was there. And he was murdered 41 or 47 days later. There was a book written a couple of years ago called Lincoln's Greatest Speech, the Second Inaugural Address. I think it's sort of making a comeback as the idea of apology. I wasn't the first to note that. I've read it one or two other places that people regard this really as an apology. There's a whole lot of other things that we do to not apologize. Nixon, Grant, and Clinton used the passive voice. That we use conditional offenses. I apologize for the alleged offense. Packwood said that after molesting the Senate pages. You can undo it with hostility. I apologize for my part in the failed marriage, but I never really loved you. Good. This is the Abu Ghraib, the use of the empathic sorry. Condoleezza Rice says, we are deeply sorry for what happened to these people and what the families must be feeling. It's just not right. That's not an apology sorry. That's an empathic sorry. And then Bush makes it worse. He apologizes to the wrong person. He apologizes to the King of Jordan. What does the King of Jordan have to do with it? He says, I was sorry for the humiliation suffered by the Iraqi prisoners and the humiliation suffered by the families. I told them I was as equally sorry that people seeing these pictures didn't understand the true nature and heart of America. It sounded like he wanted an apology from them for not thinking how wonderful we were. We weren't too wonderful, if you think of the nation. Our time is... Can I take another 5 or 8 minutes? You can apologize for the... I didn't hear any no's. Mr. Dithers wanted to apologize for Dagwood for calling him a dimwit and noodle brain, so he says, Dagwood, I'm sorry, you're a dimwit and noodle brain. A lot of these apologies are written by brilliant people, brilliant lawyers, and it doesn't make it any better. In fact, a lawyer friend told me it makes it worse. So I want to tell you one of my favorite apologies. I have to brag. I was on ESPN, the sports channel, Cold Pizza, and they asked me about these apologies. And so I tell them my favorite apology, the athletic apology, was Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, which to me, I think it's a beautiful one. It proves that you don't have to be a lawyer or have a graduate degree to know how to do it. These were guys who were decent people with good hearts and courage. So this is the apology. Before the first of 3 fights, Ali calls Frazier an Uncle Tom and too ugly to be a champ. He later compared Frazier to a gorilla. On the 30th anniversary of the first fight, an embittered Frazier, who never got over these insults, he says on TV, I don't think it was direct to Muhammad Ali, "Hey man, just come on and give me a hug and let's get on with our lives." It wasn't going to be a simple request. He wasn't demanding anything big, no reparation. Just a hug will do. Ali responds, this is beautiful, Ali, "In a way, Joe's right. I said a lot of things in the heat of the moment that I shouldn't have said. So there's an explanation to mitigate a little bit. It was the heat of the moment, but still I did bad things. It was all meant to promote the fight." You know, that's a little mitigating. "I like Joe Frazier. Me and him was a good show. It was a good traveling show." Frazier then says, "I'll accept the apology. I'll accept it, I'll shake his hand, and I'll hug him when I see him. And then this is beautiful. We're grown guys. This has been going on too long. It's like we've been fighting the Vietnam War." What a great metaphor, you know. This is going on and on with no really good reason. Am I pressing a button here? "We are two athletes of the world. Why we've been biting off bullets. We have to embrace each other. It's time to talk and get together. Life's too short." I mean, what better way, you know, what more precise apology can you make? I won't talk about explanations, but I will talk about the importance of remorse, forbearance, shame, and humility. There was a very famous college professor, not at Wellesley, who lied to his students about his military history. And he was a famous historian, so it's even lie. Maybe it's, I can't say it's, one lie is worse than another lie. But he was forced to apologize. The Boston Globe exposed it. And this is what he made 4 mistakes in 2 lines in how to apologize. First, he had his lawyer write the apology. That was already a bad one. You know, you want to hear it. Those of you who are classicists, you'll know that Agamemnon got 3 called embassies in the book to apologize to Achilles to try to get him to go back in battle, and Achilles saw right through it. And not until he looks me eye in the eye that will I accept the apology. So that was the first thing he did. Then he says, get this one, "You know, in the best of lives, mistakes are made." I think I'd kill the apology right there. I'm really a great person, so even though, you know. And then the passive voice, "Mistakes are made." That was the 3rd mistake. And then the worst thing he says, "For this and any other distortions about my personal life, I want to apologize." What other distortions? Didn't he tell us, right? So compare that to Muhammad Ali. It's no contest. Briefly, the timing of apology. It's never too late to apologize. It can be too soon to apologize. It says, if you have to eat crow, eat it when it's warm. You may not be able to eat it when it's too hot. And sometimes people will apologize too soon to prevent you from experiencing anger. If you want to hear the response to the offense, you need to listen. And it's painful to listen to someone being angry with you. So if you apologize too soon, it's a way of avoiding. I had a terrible experience. It was probably the worst day in my life in which I was got embroiled in one of these things. My sister-in-law was being seen at the famous cancer hospital in Boston. And I went there with my wife. This is my wife's youngest sister. And she went there with her husband. She had lymphoma. And I'm a big shot. I got the best lymphoma person there. And we got there at 1 o'clock when he told us and didn't see it till 5 o'clock. So I was a little irritated. You know, some clinics tell everyone to come at 1 o'clock. And so you have 50 people coming at 1, they see you 4 hours later. And it was a hard afternoon. She not only, you know, she had the baseball cap and the emaciated look, and she looked like my daughter who died several years before of breast cancer. But they looked very similar, the baseball cap, the whole thing. And so it was not a happy day. And afterwards, we stopped at a Walgreens on the way home, my wife and I, and while I was getting out of the driveway to go onto Beacon Street with the window open, somebody leaps in front of the car in an aggressive position and says, "Stick them up." And I thought I was going to have a cardiac arrest, and I turned to look who it was, panicked, and it was my nephew, the sick woman's son, who was playing a practical joke on me. Not a good time for a practical joke. So I go, we have food waiting at home, and I go there, he's already there. And he comes up to me and he says, "Uncle Aaron," he's 30 years old, by the way, "Uncle Aaron, I really got you, didn't I?" And I started to tear into him with obscenities you may not believe I'm capable of. And he's apologizing. And I remember saying, there was a sane part of my head saying, "Just shut up and let me have my 5 minutes of obscenities. And then you can apologize." And my wife was even sketchy. Aaron, you apologize. Well, he really made me feel ashamed. I like being a good host. He had driven 250 miles from Maine to come. And in the middle of this, he couldn't tolerate my anger. He turned around and walked out the door and went back home. So we both apologized. And he said, and I put it in the book, that he's glad that he contributed to my education on apologies. I won't talk about why people do and do not apologize, but you'll have to read the book for that. Two other points I want to make. An apology is not what I do to you. An apology is a negotiation. If I apologize to you, how much suffering do I have to have? How much detail do I have to offer? How much time? And a lot of times if I offend somebody, an apology, a betrayal of trust, especially between husband and wife, that's one of the worst offenses in terms of how it tears you up. There may be an apology, and then you think about it, and then there's more things that come to your mind and more memories. So it's a give and take that goes on and on. So don't think of an apology as a one-time event. When Kobe Bryant cheated on his wife, the first part of the negotiation was a $4 million diamond ring. That was just the beginning. But apologies are like that. So don't think of it as one person does to another. Think of it as an ongoing process. But I want to spend the last 5 minutes talking about the relationship of apology and forgiveness. I'll talk about the religion part is really quite interesting. And the psychological, this is not a religious book, but in my own mind, I think it's a spiritual book, but it's not a religious book. In Jewish thought, no forgiveness without repentance. Christians are really split on that. You know, in some of the New Testament will say, "Repent and you will be forgiven." And in fact, in Matthew, it says, you know, when you go to the temple, I forget what part of Matthew, and you realize you quarrel with your brother, put down the offering and go back and apologize or make it up, and then you can go back and visit with God. And in fact, Bonhoeffer, who was the Lutheran minister, was killed in the Holocaust in the concentration camp, said he coined the word cheap grace. Forgiveness without apology is cheap grace. So it's split in that. Also, there's a semantic issue in that what's the difference between forgiveness, pardon, and reconciliation? You can forgive somebody by letting the hate out of your heart. You may let the hate out of your heart, but you may not want to reconcile because, it's a dangerous relationship. It doesn't do you any good to sit there with hate. So forgiveness is different from reconciliation. When the Pope was shot by somebody 15 years ago, he forgave him, but he didn't urge him to get out of jail. He kept him there. So you have to make those distinctions. But I'm not going to talk about the religious part. I want to talk about the secular, the psychology of it. And what I want to talk about, and then finish with a brief story, is that when you meet the needs of the person, the forgiveness is spontaneous. It just comes. How many times has someone apologized to you, and you don't say, I should forgive, I'm required to forgive, or God requires me. The forgiveness is spontaneous because it has met the needs of the person. And I'll finish with this two- or three-minute story, which I think is very moving. It's from a book I read several years ago called The Railway Man. And it's a story about a British soldier who was captured in the beginning of World War II and put into a Japanese prison camp where he was tortured. And he was put into a little crate about 5 by 5 by 2.5, broiled in the sun, had water forced down his throat till he almost drowned, had all of his bones broken. There was one person who we could hear, the interpreter who was responsible for all this. He never forgot the interpreter. He survived, was discharged from the military, and lived a miserable life all of his life till his mid-70s. He got married, was divorced, he was suspicious, his emotions turned hot and cold, he lied. Everything that was adaptive to be a prisoner of war, all those traits came on. He had therapy, he had everything. Nothing helped. And all he wanted to do was find this guy and kill him. And in his 70s, he reads a magazine that this guy, this Japanese interpreter who tortured him, is writing a book about how he's been forgiven, that he's built Buddhist temples. And it was on the River Kwai, where the movie was, Bridge on the River Kwai. And he said, now I'm going to get this guy and kill him. And he had his wife arrange a meeting for he and his wife and this Japanese guy and his wife. And so they met on the River Kwai. He fantasized about the revenge he would exact from the Japanese who tortured him. He wanted also to know exactly what happened. I need to know what the offense was. I needed to go back and get the details. He said, I've got to meet him, and I've got to take him by surprise because that would give me power in there. I need power because he had the power over me. And to think that this guy says he's forgiven, when he wrote to him, his wife wrote, he says, how can you say that you've been forgiven when my husband has never forgiven you? And so the Japanese man, whose name was Takashi, responded to the letter, and he says, your letter has beaten me down wholly, reminding me of my dirty old days. The dagger of your letter thrusted me into my heart to the bottom. And he agreed to a meeting, and they got together. As he met with him, Lomax, the Brit, wanted to see him first without being seen, because that gave him some power, you know, over maybe he could do something. And then they talked. Takashi protected him from the force of the emotion, shaking his frail-seeming body. The Japanese man was shaking. Takashi then spoke. He told Lomax that the 50 years since the end of the war had been a long time, filled with his own suffering. So we got the power of the suffering. But that he never forgot Lomax's face, and he held Lomax's arm and stroked it. He noted that Takashi's grief was far more acute than mine. Takashi continued, I was a member of the Imperial Japanese Army. We treated your countrymen very, very badly. He told how he became a student of history after the war and had opposed militarism. They reminisced for several hours about their experience in the concentration camp. He was kind enough to say that compared to my suffering, his was nothing, and yet it was so obvious that he had suffered too. Lomax commented that my strange companion was a person who I would have been able to get on with long ago had we met under other circumstances. And then they left the bridge on the River Kwai and went to his home where he was a guest. And all the time I spent in Japan, Lomax said, I never felt a flash of anger that I had harbored all those years. There was, for the first time in my life, no backwash of that surge of murderous intent I felt. And then finally, at the end, he says, we've got to talk in my hotel. And I said, now he's going to kill him. And the two wives who went were terrified of this, the impending murder. And I was wondering myself. Everyone seemed afraid. In the hotel room, Lomax, then, according to Buddhist tradition, Lomax gave Takashi a letter of forgiveness. Quote, in the letter I said that the war had been over for almost 50 years, that I had suffered much, and that I knew that although he too had suffered, he had been most courageous and brave in arguing against militarism and working for reconciliation. I told him that while I could never forget what happened in Kanburi in 1943, I assured him of my total forgiveness. And that was, at the end of the book, Lomax says, meeting Nagase has turned him from a hated enemy with whom friendship would have been unthinkable into a blood brother. If I've never been able to put a name to the face of the men who had harmed me and never discovered that behind that face there was also a damaged life, the nightmares would always have come from a past without meaning. And I had proof for myself that remembering alone is not enough. Remembering alone is not enough. There has to be an exchange of suffering. There has to be an acknowledgement of what happened. There has to be a show of a change of heart. Everything that happened to me was just further proof that these are the functions that lead to forgiveness, a spontaneous forgiveness. It didn't have to come from a religious duty or a moral duty or anything like that. So I'm going to just finish by saying that there's a whole international thing that bothers me about this, in that it's wonderful that people are looking to apologies, but nations that are humiliated can't apologize. If you come from a humiliated background, there's just too much hate in your heart, and you're too vulnerable. And I think that's the problem right now between Israel and Palestine. These are two nations who come from humiliated backgrounds. The Israelis bring the Holocaust, and the Palestinians, they've had their share of being pushed around and discriminated against. And some people even think that the United States is behaving like a humiliated nation, you know, after 9/11. Like, we got to find someone to have a fight with. And so maybe that's going to be the clash of whether we're going to be able to acknowledge when we make mistakes or whether we're going to behave like animals. But just in conclusion, I'd say that an apology is an act of honesty. It's an act of generosity. It's an act of humility. It's an act of courage. And it's an act of commitment. And not easy to do, but I'm still working on it. I hope you will, too. Thank you.